Mr. Wallace, and also for the good wishes for my birthday. Indeed, it's an honor to be here and speak with all of you. And in the spirit of civil society, I would like to start by quoting some of the civil society groups from the countries we work with. When the pandemic started, they said, "We will stay at home, but we will not give up our constitutionally guaranteed rights." And I think this is really important to mention because it was a remarkable spirit which civil society kept throughout this whole time and let them face the unprecedented challenges, but to remain resilient. Indeed, we have run a civic freedom tracker during the pandemic to identify what kind of measures and responses states undertook. I would like to focus on that. And I would also like to speak about the civil society resilience I mentioned. And I would like to conclude by also sharing an example of one UN document which was instrumental as the pandemic was unfolding. So first, in terms of state responses, as Faith said, there were many challenges coming up of the measures. Indeed, the COVID-19 civic freedom tracker we have identified 109 countries with different types of emergency measures. There were 152 measures affecting freedom of assembly, 61 privacy, 58 freedom of expression. These are not just numbers. These show how the restrictions on civil liberties were dominant during this time. Indeed, many governments, as the pandemic started, shielded themselves. They limited movement, they limited protests, they limited participation in policymaking. This gave them the space to keep the adopted measures out of public scrutiny. They concentrated executive power and limited parliamentary oversight. They also adopted emergency measures without time limit, without stopping. These are one of the biggest threats to democracies because they still remain in many of the countries, even though the pandemic has changed. Governments imposed a blanket ban on assemblies in public spaces. These were the most dominant restrictions on civil liberties. They allowed military to take part in patrols in streets, raising fear among population. We've heard many other examples from Faith. They also imposed heavy fines. For example, in one country, the fine to take part in assembly was amounting to 5,000 euros or imprisonment. Governments made it difficult for organizations to also have meetings of their governing bodies online, because apparently their laws only allowed for physical meetings. This meant that organizations couldn't get together with their boards to make important decisions about their work. The limitation on movement did not allow them to go and support deprived communities who really desperately needed help at that time. Governments also used this vacuum of no consultations to be and kind of no parliamentary oversight to adopt also laws which did not relate to the pandemic, for example, on environment or surveillance, which until today remain and which limited freedoms and were not part of any consultation. So in some, civil society was not just under attack because it was limited in taking part in decisions, delivering services, in voicing opinions during policymaking, but were also criminalized as Faith and in many other countries. But this is a problem because as the pandemic is changing and restrictions are lifted, many of the restrictions on the civil liberties are remaining. So for example, while countries are removing restrictions on movement and they're allowing, for example, commercial activities, sports events, the restrictions on protests remain. I would also like to point out that in many countries, governments really managed to find the balance between the pandemic and preserving our right to health, and in the same time, finding ways to balance with the civil liberties we should and we have the right to enjoy. So for example, they shared more publicly information and data about the pandemic with wider groups in different languages. They created online portals for collaboration. They had portals for government decision-making together with people. They introduced technologies with tracking. I would be happy to talk about this later. Civil society responded with power and with determination. They started to organize more online. They organized debates and dialogues around different measures to voice and gather massive communities to speak about their concerns so that the governments can hear what they were feeling. They were also finding alternative ways to assemble. So for example, they went online and did protests online. One such protest attracted 40,000 people before it was shut down by the government and the website where it was taking place. In other examples, people found a way to also protest and meet and assemble in physical space by respecting the restrictions or finding ways to navigate the restrictions. So for example, in one country, women avoided the restrictions of protests by taking advantage of the freedom to go shopping. So they went and to shops, queued in front of them, wearing masks and slogans and voicing their opinion against bans on abortion. People clapped hands, banged pots, and also filled parliament squares with empty shoes in order to show that they are present and they have the opinions. Importantly, civil society went to court to challenge laws. There are lots of judgments we can look at in national courts that can give us an insight into what were the issues and how the courts were understanding the importance of civil liberties. So courts stood on the side of civil society. They said governments, they annulled government decisions to publish the name of individuals who were ordered to self-isolate. In another decision, in another ruling, the court decided that ministerial orders or restrictions in the name of emergencies are not in line with constitutional rights. For example, rulings on freedom of assemblies, court said, which are blanket ban, are also unconstitutional. They made governments or instructed governments to find ways to deal with the freedom of assembly in a way in which it would still allow people to come together. For example, to determine the specific case of the assembly, to work with organizers to create health conditions that would allow them to speak, but not determine to not be on the image of the others. There were also examples where governments wanted to prohibit publication of statements criticizing actions of governments, and the courts suspended those. So the national courts were really important. And finally, the international bodies. In July 2020, the UN Human Rights Committee adopted the first ever General Comment Number 37 on the right of peaceful assembly. And it really came in a critical moment, because it helped capture evolutionary moment of how assemblies take place online, through phones, through internet, through social media. The general comment elevated the right to assemble, even at times of emergencies, and even by using online spaces. And this really gave protections to groups who were trying to find a way how to assemble while navigating the restrictions they were having or complying with them. So what we can learn from this in conclusion? I think we can learn that there are enough standards and states, and as courts have said, should really adopt emergency measures only in a limited form and should be subject to extension only upon legislative approval. They should be developed in consultation with civil society. Restrictions on expression or assembly or association can exist, but they should include reasonable exceptions in line with the prescribed norms. Governments can use digital technology, but they should also, in the same time, respect the rules around privacy of individuals and have wide consultations to make sure that happens. And finally, I really think we should stop and impose on the important role of the international community, which continues to review the international standards, learns from these examples we are sharing, gathers the knowledge from the national courts, and try to really improve the standards that they're there, in order to ensure better protection and give guidance to states on how to balance this right to health and balance to fundamental freedom. In the end, I would like to end also with a kind of note about the civil society resilience. The space we're working is really complex, but the resilience of civil society and fight for freedoms always prevail, and we really need to invest in such protections. Thank you.